From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Lodger in Room 16 by David Dixon. There was something rather odd about the lodger in Room 16, and Mr. Fyfe didn't think he could stand any more of it. Right now, he was stooped at the keyhole of his next-door neighbor like a huge, ball-headed bird looking for worms, but all he could see was the corner of a crude, hefty wooden table, which told him nothing it had not told him on many previous inspections. His innate timidity restricted his investigation to the daylight hours when he knew the lodger must be out, and it was only during these hours that he tried the door. It was always locked. A little later, Mr. Fyfe left the lodging house in a very determined frame of mind. He walked briskly in a district of empty warehouses and dilapidated buildings. Evening was drawing in. The streets were always deserted after dark, due jointly to marauding packs of vandals and a strange series of disappearances which had plagued the area for years. This suited Mr. Fyfe perfectly. He had on a black overcoat two sizes too big for him and which he seldom took off, and pebble glass spectacles that magnified his eyes to look like slugs wallowing darkly in axle grease. He was panting, for he tended always to walk faster than he was fit for. It was trying to rain. Mr. Fyfe had a rolled-up newspaper under an arm when he returned to the lodging house some 10 minutes later. A barbed yellow light beneath the door under the ground-floor stairs betrayed the presence of the landlord within. Mr. Fyfe delivered one startling rap on the door with a knuckle. "Go away," commanded a muffled voice. Mr. Fyfe stood his ground. He waited 2 whole minutes patiently, then delivered a second stunning rap on the door. There followed a muffled curse, and the door was snatched open. The landlord glared down at the bent, bird-like figure before him, whose spectacles reflected the light of the room to look like dim headlamps in its face. "Well?" he barked impatiently. Mr. Fyfe insinuated himself into the room, which was packed to the ceiling with a scruffy and rusty collection of junk. The landlord shut the door with a necessary loudness as Mr. Fyfe explained his visit. "I wish to speak with you, Mr. Moulet, about certain disturbances on the top floor which are making my stay here difficult." "I haven't the time for it," snapped the landlord. "If I remember correctly, Mr. Fyfe, you took that room on the understanding that if it wasn't to your satisfaction, you'd find another elsewhere. That's my understanding of the matter, Mr. Fyfe. And I'll thank you to remember that you demanded that room and made a nuisance of yourself about it after I told you them rooms up there wasn't for letting. And I'll thank you to remember that I didn't show you the top floor or offer you a room anywhere. You found it yourself." "Nevertheless, Mr. Moulet, these disturbances must stop," said Mr. Fyfe with determination. "I don't know what number 16 is up to, but I think that as a landlord you should be concerned about it. I believe that something is being willfully and maliciously destroyed in there at night, sometimes as much as 3 times a week, sir. There seems to be a crank-handled device in there which sounds to me rusty, Mr. Moulet, and the machine's task involves a sound that I can only describe as that of crunching sticks. Crunching sticks, Mr. Moulet, is as near as I can describe it. In fact, it was intolerable. The disturbances always lasted about 45 minutes and were thunderous, the shuddering noise seeming to interfere with every atom of Mr. Fyfe's body. They could occur on any night and at any hour after dark. Mr. Fyfe feared most of all those that happened in the small hours, when his sleep would be troubled by appalling dreams, and he would awake in a cold sweat in the dark and find himself listening to that infernally chilling sound, the scraping, ponderous turn of the crack handle, and the sound of crunching sticks. The paranoid degree of anxiety that he felt at these times seemed to bring him to the brink of insanity. "Is that all you wanted to say, Mr. Fyfe?" Indeed, I believe I hardly need say more to arouse your professional concern, Mr. Moulet. Then no doubt you'll be anxious to leave, said the landlord, turning to the door. Let's not go poking our nose into other people's business, Mr. Faith. The man in number 16 works in a local cemetery and would not be pleased at your interest in his affairs, I've no doubt. You took that room on the understanding that if you had any complaints, you'd find another elsewhere. My advice is to do just that. But wait a moment, Mr. Faith protested. Now, said the landlord, helping him out through the door. That's all I got to say on the matter, and that's that. Back in his room, with a door locked, Mr. Faith stood at his window thoughtfully. The view here was cluttered with archaic roofs and chimneys of various sizes and shapes, and part of a cinema could be seen amidst them, its neon signs lighting up his face dimly pink, then blue, then pink again. After trying the crossword, Mr. Faith took his Daily Telegraph apart and changed some of the old newspaper sheets on his bed with it. He worked by the glow of the cinema signs, for he liked to save on electricity. He went to bed much later with a sick lump of dread in his stomach and slept fitfully all night. The house remained tomb-like in its silence, however, and this was not what Mr. Faith had expected. The following morning he rose in a very grim mood, for the constant dread of nights was becoming insufferable. Though the disturbances were by no means regular, the lapses between them never exceeded 5 nights, and last night had been the 5th. He would have to look forward to a disturbance all over again, this time with a certainty of no reprieve. Mr. Faith was furious. He brushed his teeth venomously in the 4th-floor bathroom, and after a wrathful shave, emerged in the gloomy corridor with small pieces of pink lavatory paper pressed on his bleeding jowls. The fact that the man worked among the dead and committed God knows what crimes after dark did not frighten Mr. Faith a bit now that he was angry. When he got back to his room, he wrote out a very stiff note, in which he advised the recipient that should the disturbances continue, he would have no further recourse but to notify the police. He slipped the note under the door of number 16 and waited perfunctorily for signs of response. But of course, there were none. He tried the door, but it was locked. He then left the lodging house to pick up his dole money, for it was Thursday. He bore a plastic carrier bag that contained library books due for replacement. It was dark when he returned, and it was trying to rain again. Behind the lodging house was a pitch-dark cobbled square. It lay by the side of a road that fortunately was well enough lit. On the other side of the road to the square, Mr. Faith emerged from a beaten path that was crowded by trees and wild vegetation. The bank of verdure at his right screened a cemetery of considerable age, reputedly, though it couldn't be connected with his next-door neighbor, since it had been abandoned to riotous vegetation long ago. The soil here smelt overpoweringly rich and nutritious, and the wild weeds beyond the trees were gigantic, with stems as thick as Mr. Faith's wrists. Walking briskly, Mr. Faith disappeared into the square, where he met with something of an accident. For he had forgotten that the dustbins belonging to the buildings on the three sides of the square were always strung across its center. He had formerly complained of this to the landlord on many occasions, for it constituted a danger at night. He had even been able to describe a lodger whom he believed guilty of placing the obstruction, a small, mad-looking skeleton of a man with shriveled eyes and a dry, cynical voice, who in the summer always walked down to the news agents in overcoat, pajamas, and slippers. Mr. Faith's collision was thunderous. He was just getting the hang of his prostrate circumstances when a sash window slammed open up above. The light of the obscured street lamp nearest the square flooded over a wall and illuminated a double-barreled shotgun as it peered furtively out of a window halfway up the back of one of the lodging houses. The dry, hairless head of Mr. Faith's dustbin suspect appeared cautiously behind the weapon. "Who goes there?" barked. Mr. Faith conveyed his identity and circumstances with restrained exasperation and announced that he would deliver a written complaint to the landlord about the dustbins. "You leave them bloody dustbins be," the old man retorted with hostility. "I saw someone coming up by that old cemetery down there just now, Mr. Feet, and I've got this here notion maybe it was you. You keep well away from that place. That's my advice to you." Having by now regathered his library books and repositioned his spectacles, Mr. Faith remained politely to inquire what the devil the madman was talking about. "If you can't take advice without asking bloody questions all the time, you don't bloody well deserve any. I've been here a long time, Mr. Feet, and I got a sharp eye in my head. That there is the devil's graveyard, and woe betide any man what gets himself buried in it." Mr. Faith assured the old man that he had no intention of being interred there. "You just hope and pray that may be the case, and God be thanked," said the old man darkly, "for there is a great evil at large in this godless neighborhood, with folks being nicked out of their very beds o' night these many years," he added, crossing himself feverishly. "And what does this devil look like, then?" Mr. Faith inquired contemptuously. "Does he have horns, like the books have it, and a tail?" "He don't look healthy, Mr. Feet," said the old man with a shudder, "and that's no exaggeration. He's horribly fat and gray. He looks rotten, Mr. Feet, soft and rotten like an overripe plum. And then there is his head." "What's wrong with that?" "I don't like to think on it," said the old man with horror. "You keep well away from that place. That's my advice to you. You'll be good enough to set that dustbin up before you go, else I'll not rest peaceful in my bed tonight." Mr. Faith couldn't stand this old man, whose personal abandon and madness represented the very depth of human degradation. Indeed, it was only with a nauseous taste in his mouth that he was able to associate with anybody reduced to living in a house of this quality. He was fortunate with the timing of the disturbance that night. Instead of having to wait up half the night in order to avoid having his sleep poisoned with it, he had to listen to it somewhat before midnight, while the cinema lights were still on. The sound began with a familiar scraping screech of what Mr. Faith took to be a crank handle. This continued at brief regular intervals, punctuating the ceaseless muffled crunching stick noises, which then commenced. Thereafter, Mr. Faith's room was filled and ravaged by the physical presence of noise. The dust on the floor rose up and hung like a ground mist over the floorboards. Mr. Faith found it hard to believe that nobody beneath heard this racket, and once again the inevitable question rose in the thunder: what on earth was his neighbor doing in there? Even though the rubber soles of his slippers, he could feel the boards throb in rhythm with the activity in the next room. The vibration would deaden his ankles soon into unaccountable numbness, and the dust would scour his lungs. In exasperation, Mr. Faith did something he had often thought of doing before, but in the dark hours had always lacked the character for. He took almost 2 minutes to turn the key in his door as noiselessly as possible, and crept down the corridor to the door of room 16. The sound here was so quiet that until he reached the door he suspected that it might have stopped. The door glowed dimly around its edges, and at the keyhole Mr. Faith stooped and applied an eye to the keyhole. The light within was tremulous, and its unsteadiness seemed to increase and subside with a scraping churn of the crank handle. Mr. Faith thought it might be that of a candle, and wondered why his neighbor didn't use his electricity. The view was dominated by the corner of the crude table, as was to be expected, but Mr. Faith's attention was drawn by something else, something that he couldn't quite get the hang of at first. It overhung the edge of the table a little and seemed to be of an apricot hue, with bluish discoloring. It was badly crumpled. Mr. Faith thought it might be made of some kind of flexible rubber. It wobbled and vibrated with the same throbbing rhythm as that of the unseen candle, and it sometimes advanced jerkily down over the edge of the table, which seemed to strain to the same rhythm, though it appeared to be stoutly made. Mr. Faith wondered if the rubber thing might be some kind of long-sleeved glove, since he suspected that he could make out the fingers, but as the sleeve grew longer and longer, he became doubtful. He didn't like the texture of it at all. He remained long enough to watch the scene shudder and strain once more, and to see the rubber oddity on the table make one further jerky reach for the bottom of his field of view. Then he rose to go. Unfortunately, he applied his weight to the door handle, for his back was not what it had been. When his weight was at its greatest, he lost his grip. The handle made a thunderous clunk in its housing, and Mr. Faith found to his stunned alarm that the door stood 6 inches ajar. It opened to the left so that he could see nothing of his neighbor, but it was clear that his neighbor was aware of his presence and had stopped work. Mr. Faith could hear quite plainly now the slow wheezing respiration of the man inside, who sounded grotesquely fat and bronchial. Mr. Faith had never previously heard so much as a footstep of him. It occurred to him that he might enter and communicate his grievances in person, and it was no doubt this very idea which precipitated his hasty retreat, in which he cared little for the racket he made. He locked his door hastily and drew his armchair against it. He stood by his window, perhaps because it presented a comforting token of egress. While waiting, his dimly blue then pink then blue face was frozen with apprehension. After a few minutes, however, the grinding scrape of the crank handle announced the resumption of his neighbor's mysterious labors, and Mr. Faith opened his window to let in some fresh air. The following day, he descended the dark stair flights in a very determined frame of mind. "What the devil do you want now?" the landlord snarled, snatching open his door. "I wish to speak to you about that man in room 16," said Mr. Faith firmly. He tried to insinuate himself into the landlord's room, but physical obstruction on the latter's part kept him out. Mr. Faith could see dozens of food mixers in their boxes, stacked up amongst the cluttered junk within. Mr. Mullet was in the habit of receiving at regular intervals, usually at night, large consignments of cassette radios, watches, and other valuables of this kind, and furtive men visited him frequently. Mr. Faith had never been in any doubt but that Mr. Mullet had business of dark merit and doubtful honor on the side. "I think I already told you to keep your nose out of his affairs, Mr. Faith, and if you had any brains, you wouldn't forget it so easy." Mr. Faith was determined not to be offended. "As I was going to say, this man started a disturbance last night, and I looked through the keyhole and observed candlelight in the room." Mr. Faith proceeded to describe what he had seen through the keyhole. He didn't mention how he had accidentally opened the door, nor the threatening note he had rashly delivered, which now weighed so heavily on his peace of mind. "I suspect that something is being willfully and maliciously destroyed in there at night, and I submit, Mr. Mullet, that it must stop. I suggest we take a key upstairs, the pair of us, and have a look inside." "I don't have a key to number 16, said the landlord. Mr. Faith couldn't hide his astonishment. "Do you mean to say that you haven't a spare key to one of your own rooms, Mr. Mullet?" "I do," enunciated the landlord. Mr. Faith became uncomfortably aware of one particular eye, rheumy and bloodshot, bulging at him belligerently. "The man in number 16 is no lodger of mine, Mr. Faith. He came with the house, and is none of my business or yours." "I don't believe I understand, Mr. Mullet." "I couldn't care less, Mr. Faith." Mr. Faith thought of something else. "And that's another thing. Why is it that you're prepared to do the rounds for everybody, knocking on their doors for their rent money, while I have to come down here to pay mine? This seems a little unfair, doesn't it?" "I never go on the top floor, Mr. Faith, and don't plan to change me habits. I don't need any trouble around here, for reasons you'll no doubt understand. And I'd advise you to keep your nose to yourself if it's a cheap roof over your head you want. That's all I got to say on it, and that's that." Back on the top floor, Mr. Faith stooped to the keyhole of room 16, but all he could see was the corner of the table in the gloom. The strange rubber thing had gone. Then he tried the door, and something unexpected happened. It opened. The room seemed to have been left for his inspection. He opened the door wider and stepped to the threshold of the room. A timid peer revealed the occupant to be absent. The object that stole his attention was a table in the middle of the room, or at least the filthy machinery that it supported. Apart from this, the room was little furnished. There was a battered wardrobe at one end, and curtains of grimy cobwebs hung on each side of the little window. The thick carpet of dust was badly scuffed around the table. There was a reek of old sacks and God knew what else in the room. The sight of the mangle made Mr. Faith feel ill. It was bolted on the table excessively, and the table was extensively strutted underneath with ironwork and itself was bolted to the floor. The rollers were almost as big as dustbins. One of them was set into the table with only about 3 inches protruding, while the height of the others appeared to be adjustable. an adjustable flap of rubber hung against the upper roller on the outside, covering the gap beneath. A badly stained gutter ran around the far sides of the table at an angle, and a battered, filthy-looking bucket stood underneath its end, covered with a ragged scrap of matting. The whole contraption was perhaps the most repulsive thing that he had ever seen. Gingerly, Mr. Faith entered the room. The electric lighting consisted of stripped wires hanging uselessly like cobwebs from a hole in the ceiling, and Mr. Faith supposed that the furry mass of cobwebs by the wardrobe must be the slot meter. The wardrobe contained a dirty pile of sacks and two slugs. It also contained dozens of crudely fashioned wax-like objects that resembled the half-used candle he found under a window, a misshapen oddity welded onto an enamel plate in its own wax. There was a primitive tinderbox on the windowsill with blobs of dirt all over it. Mr. Faith could see no sign of his threatening note anywhere. He wondered why he had been allowed in, or if the occupant had simply slipped up. Outside was raining hard. The monotonous murmurs and mutterings of it had been a constant companion for Mr. Faith all morning. He looked idly out the window. Though he couldn't see very clearly through the rain patterns on the glass, the flat gray wash of the courtyard and the green of the trees beyond were discernible. Sometimes even these were obliterated when sudden gusts of wind lashed the back of the house with rain. Mr. Faith began to suspect that, through the rivulets of water on the glass, he could make out an unexpected form near the trees by the abandoned cemetery. He pressed his nose against the glass and peered into the rain. He could hardly see much better, and the condensation on this side of the glass caused by his breath wasn't helping much. It was unquestionably a man. He looked bloodless, large, and repulsively fat, and seemed to have something black and shiny, perhaps an oilskin, in one mushy-looking hand. Mr. Faith did not think the head should look as mushy and featureless as it did. He became overwhelmed with a giddy sickness at the sight of the man. The man was gazing up at the back of the house, and the possibility that he was aware of Mr. Faith's peering at him from the window of room 16 could not be discounted. Mr. Faith ducked out of sight. Perhaps he was being imaginative, but if the mysterious man in room 16 looked like anything, surely he would look like that thing outside, like some kind of maggot that crawled out of the soil to commit obscene crimes amongst humanity at night. Mr. Faith believed that he had been discovered in his snooping by the very man who occupied the room. Perhaps it had been the smell in the room, or perhaps Mr. Faith was overreacting. But for the rest of that day, he felt very ill indeed, and confined himself to his room with the door locked. His illness seemed, if anything, to worsen as night drew in. He had seated himself on the square of hardboard that served to protect his backside from the vicious springs of his gutted armchair. He sat like this until late into the night, unable to move, the cold dampness of the climate drenching him to the bones. Late that night, Mr. Faith was roused from a stupor by the sound of a slow, heavy tread on the top of the stairs, and a vaguely familiar wheezing noise. Mr. Faith listened, barely breathing, as the tread proceeded down the landing, the wheezing sound getting louder. It passed room 16 and came towards the only other door at this end, that of Mr. Faith. The tread stopped outside Mr. Faith's door, and nothing could be heard for a bit except the wheezing. Mr. Faith, in the neon-lit gloom of his room, remained frozen where he sat, numbed with terror and dismay. His visitor then began to grope on the surface of the door. The sound of this was horribly soft and unmethodical. Soon the door handle was struck a couple of times, then turned. As the door strained and cracked behind him, Mr. Faith shrieked without restraint. Rotten bits of wood spat out from around the lock and scattered on the floor, and as the door split asunder, sickening stench of wet soil and dead cats invaded the room. In common with Mr. Faith's life, his disappearance passed unnoticed by the world in which he lived. His screams wandered along all the dark corridors of the house for over a minute, but no one stirred. Some 50 minutes later, the tread of a descender could have been heard on the stairs and a bronchial wheezing, which some of the lodgers might have noticed before in the house, but nobody reported it to the police. A suspicious lodger on the ground floor might have been able to furnish the police with a description of the descender, since the hall light, unlike those of the upper corridors and stairs, was kept in serviceable order. and it remained switched on day and night, but the hall was deserted when the man on the stairs arrived. No one was there to see the descender in such detail, or to smell the appalling reek of corruption that hung about him, and no one was there to connect the screams with the hideous burden that he had slung over his shoulder, a filthy oilskin sack, which had in it something half as massive and heavy, something that filled a sack like laundry, and bobbed up and down rather flabbily on his back as he made his way out. Dog or Demon by Theo Gift. The following pages came into my hands shortly after the writer's death. He was a brother officer of my own, has served under me with distinction in the last Afghan campaign, and was a young man of great spirit and promise. He left the army on the occasion of his marriage with a very beautiful girl, the daughter of a Leicestershire baronet, and I partially lost sight of him for some little time afterwards. I can, however, vouch for the accuracy of the principal facts herein narrated, and of the story generally, the sad fate of the family having made a profound impression, not only in the district in Ireland where the tragedy occurred, but throughout the country. Signed, William J. Porlock, Lieutenant Colonel, the Curragh, County Kildare. At last she is dead. It came to an end today, all that long agony, those heart-rending cries and moans, the terrified shuddering of that poor, wasted body, the fixed and maddened glare, more awful for its very unconsciousness. Only this very day they faded out and died one by one, as death crept at last up the tortured and emaciated limbs, and I stood over my wife's body and tried to thank God for both our sakes that it was all over. And yet it was I who had done it, I who killed her. Not meaningly or of intent, I will swear that, not even so that the laws of this earth can punish me, but truly, willfully, all the same, of my own brutal, thoughtless selfishness. I put it all down in my diary at the time. I tear out the pages that refer to it now, and insert them here, that when those few friends who still care for me hear the end, they may know how it came about. June 10, 1878, Castle Kilmoyle, Kerry. Arrived here today with K, after a hard battle to get away from Lily, who couldn't bear me going, and tried all manner of arguments to keep me from leaving her. "What do you have to do with Lord Kilmoyle's tenants?" she would keep on asking. "They owe no rent to you. Oh, Harry, do let them alone and stay here. If you go with him, you'll be sure to come in for some of the ill-feeling that already exists against himself, and I shall be so miserably anxious all the time. Pray don't go." I told her, however, that I must, first because I had promised, and men don't like going back from their word without any cause, and secondly because Kilmoyle would be desperately offended with me if I did. The fact is, I hadn't seen him for 3 years till we met at that tennis party at the Fitzherberts last week, and when he asked me if I would like to run over for a week's fishing at his place in Ireland and help him to enforce the eviction of a tenant who declined either to pay for the house he lived in or leave it, I accepted with effusion. It would be a spree. I had nothing to do, and I really wanted a little change and waking up. As for Lily, her condition naturally makes me rather nervous and fanciful at present, and to have me dancing attendance on her does her more harm than good. I told her so, and asked her, with half a dozen kisses, if she'd like to tie me to her apron string altogether. She burst out crying, and said she would. There is no use in reasoning with a dear little girl at present. She is better with her sisters. June 12th. We have begun the campaign by giving the tenant 24 hours' notice to quit or pay Kilmoyle, and are rode down with the bailiff to the cottage, a well-built stone one in the loveliest glen ever dreamt of out of fairyland, to see it served ourselves. The door was shut and barred, and as no answer save a fierce barking from within responded to our knock, we were beginning to think that the tenant had saved us the trouble of evicting him by decamping of his own accord, when on crossing round the side of the house, where there was a small unglazed window, we came in full view of him, seated as coolly as possible beside a bare hearthstone, with a pipe in his mouth and a big brown dog between his knees. His hair, which was snow white, hung over his shoulders, and his face was brown to the color of mahogany by exposure to sun and wind, but he might have been carved out of mahogany, too, for all the sign of attention that he gave while the bailiff repeated his messages, until Kilmoyle, losing patience, tossed a written copy of the notice into him through the open window with a threat that unless he complied with it, he would be smoked out of the place like a rat, after which we rode off, followed by a perfect pandemonium of barks and howls from the dog, a lean and hideous mongrel, who seemed to be only held by force from flying at our throats. We had a jolly canter over the hills afterwards, selecting the bit of river that seemed most suitable for our fishing on the morrow, and wound up the day with a couple of bottles of champagne at dinner, after which Kilmoyle was warmed up into making me an offer which I accepted on the spot, i.e., to let me have the identical cottage we had been visiting, rent-free, with right of shooting and fishing for 2 years, on condition only of my putting and keeping it in order for that time. I wonder what Lily will say to the idea. She hates Ireland almost as much as Kilmoyle's tenants are supposed to hate him, but really it would cost mighty little to make a more picturesque little place of the cabin in question, and I believe we should both find it highly enjoyable to run down here for a couple of months' change in the autumn, after a certain and much looked forward to event is well over. June 19th. The job is done, and the man out, and Kilmoyle and I shook hands laughingly today over our victory as he handed me the key in token of my new tenantship. It had been rather an exciting bit of work, however, for the fellow, an ill-conditioned old villain, who hasn't paid a stiver of rent for the last 12 months and only a mockum for the 3 previous years, wouldn't quit, set all threats, persuasions, and warnings at defiance, and simply sat within his door with a loaded gun in his hand, and kept it pointed at anyone who tried to approach him. In the end, and to avoid bloodshed, we had to smoke him out. There was nothing else for it, for though we took care that none of the neighbors should come near the house with food, he was evidently prepared to starve where he was rather than budge an inch. And on the third day, Donovan the bailiff told Kilmoyle that if he didn't want it to come to that, he must have in the help either of the peelers or a bit of smoke. Kilmoyle vowed he wouldn't have the peelers, anyhow. He had said he'd put the man out himself, and he'd do it. And the end of it was, we first had the windows shuttered up from outside, a sod put in the chimney, and then the door taken off its hinges, while the tenant's attention was momentarily distracted by the former operations. Next, a good big fire of damp weeds, which had been piled up outside, was set alight, and after that there was nothing to do but wait. It didn't take long. The wind was blowing strong in the direction of the house, and the dense volume of thick, acrid smoke would have driven me out in about 5 minutes. As for the tenant, he was probably more hardened on the subject of atmosphere generally, for he managed to stand it for nearly half an hour, and until Kilmoyle and I were almost afraid to keep it up, lest he should let himself be smothered out of sheer obstinacy. Just as I was debating, however, whether I wouldn't brave the gun and make a rush for him at all cost, nature or vindictiveness got the better of his perversity. A dark figure staggered through the stifling vapor to the door, fired wildly in the direction of Kilmoyle without hitting him, thank God, and then dropped, a miserable object, purple with suffocation and black with smoke, upon the threshold, whence some of the keepers dragged him out into the fresh air and poured a glass of whiskey down his throat, just too late to prevent his fainting away. 5 minutes later, the fire was out, the window opened, and 2 stalwart Scotch keepers put in charge of the dwelling while Kilmoyle and I went home to dinner, and the wretched old man, who had given us so much trouble for nothing, was conveyed in a handcart to the village by some of his neighbors, who had been looking on from a distance and beguiling the time by hooting and groaning at us. "Who wants the police in these cases?" said Kilmoyle triumphantly. "To my mind, Glenny, it's mere cowardice to send for those poor fellows to enforce orders. We ought to be able to carry out for ourselves, so get them into odium with the whole neighborhood. We manage this capitally by ourselves, and upon my word, I couldn't help agreeing heartily with him. Indeed, the whole affair had gone off with only 1 trifling accident, and that was no one's fault but the tenant's. It seems that for the last 2 days his abominable dog had been tied up in a miserable little pigsty a few yards from the house. Donovan having threatened him that if the brute flew at or bit anyone, it would be shot instantly. Nobody was aware of this, however, and unfortunately, when the bonfire was at its height, a blazing twig fell on the roof of this little shelter and set it alight. The clouds of smoke, which were blowing that way, hiding what had happened until the wretched animal inside was past rescue, while even its howls attracted no attention from the simple fact that not only but a score of other curs belonging to the neighbors round had been making as much noise as they could from the commencement of the affair. Now, of course, we hear that the evicted tenant goes about swearing that we deliberately and out of malice burnt his only friend alive, and calling down curses on our heads in consequence. I don't think we are much affected by them, however. Why didn't he untie the poor brute himself? June 22nd. A letter from Lady Fitzherbert, Lily's eldest sister, telling me she thinks I had better come back at once. L, not at all well, nervous about me, and made more, instead of less so, by my account of our successful raid. What a fool I was to write it. I thought she would be amused, but the only thing now is to get back as quickly as possible, and I started this morning, Kilmoyle's driving me to the station. We were bowling along pretty fast, when as we turned a bend in the road, the horse swerved suddenly to one side, and the off-wheel of the trap went over something with that sickening sort of jolt, the meaning of which some of us know by experience, and which made Kilmoyle exclaim, "Good heavens, we've run over something!" Fortunately, nothing to hurt. Nothing but the carcass of a dead dog, whose charred and blackened condition would have been sufficiently identified it with a victim of Tuesday's bonfire, even if we had not now perceived its late owner, seated among the heather near the roadside, and occupied in pouring forth a string of wailing sounds, which might have been either prayers or curses for aught we could tell, though while he waved his shaggy white head and brown claw-like hands to and fro in union. I yelled at him to know why he had left his brute of a dog there to upset travelers, but he paid no attention and did not seem to hear, and as we were in a hurry to catch the train, we could not afford to waste words on him, but drove on. June 26, Holly Lodge, West Kensington. This day sees me the proud father of a son and heir, now just 5 hours old, and though rather too red for beauty, a very sturdy youngster, with a fine pair of lungs of his own. Lily says she is too happy to live, and as the dread of losing her has been the one thought of the last 24 hours, it is a comfort to know from the doctor that this means she has got through it capitally and is doing as well as can be expected. Thank God for all his mercies. July 17th. Lily has had a nasty fright this evening, for which I hope she won't be any worse. She was lying on a couch out on the veranda for the first time since her convalescence, and I had been reading to her till she fell asleep, when I closed the book, and leaving the bell beside her in case she should want anything, went into my study to write letters. I hadn't been there for half an hour, however, when I was startled by a cry from Lily's voice and a sharp ringing of the bell, which made me fling open the study window and dart round to the veranda at the back of the house. It was empty, but in the drawing room within, Lily was standing upright, trembling with terror and clinging to her maid, while she tried to explain to her that there was someone hidden in the veranda or close by, though so incoherently, owing to the state of agitation she was in, that it was not until I and the manservant had searched veranda, garden, and outbuildings, and found nothing, that I was even able to understand what had frightened her. It appeared then that she had suddenly been awakened from sleep by the pressure of a heavy hand on her shoulder and a hot breath, so close it seemed as if someone were about to whisper in her ear, upon her cheek. She started up crying out, "Who's that? What is it?" but was only answered by a hasty withdrawal of the pressure and the pit-pat of heavy but shoeless feet retreating through the dusk to the further end of the veranda. In a sudden access of ungovernable terror, she screamed out, sprang to her feet, ringing the bell as she did so, and rushed into the drawing room, where she was fortunately joined by her maid, who had been passing through the hall when the bell rang. Well, as I said, we searched high and low, and not a trace of any intruder could we find, nay, not even a stray cat or dog, and we have none of our own. The garden isn't large, and there is neither tree nor shrub in it big enough to conceal a boy. The gate leading into the road was fastened inside, and the wall is too high for easy climbing, while the maid, having been in the hall, could certify that no one had passed out through the drawing room. Finally, I came to the conclusion that the whole affair was the outcome of one of those very vivid dreams which sometimes come to us in the semi-conscious moment between sleep and waking. And though Lily, of course, wouldn't hear of such an idea, for a long while, I think even she began to give into it after the doctor had been sent for and had pronounced it the only rational one and given her a composing draught before sending her off to bed. At present, she is sleeping soundly, but has been a disturbing evening, and I'm glad it's over. September 26. Have seen Dr. C. today, and he agrees with me that there is nothing for it but change and bracing air. He declares the fright Lily had in July must have been much more serious than we imagined, and that she has never got over it. She seemed to do so. She was out and about after her confinement as soon as other people, but I remember now her nerves seemed gone from the first. She was always startling, listening, and trembling without any cause, except that she appeared in constant alarm lest something should happen to the baby, as I took that to be a common weakness with young mothers over the first child. I'm afraid I paid no attention to it. We've a very nice nurse for the boy, a young Irish woman named Bridget McBean. Not that she's ever seen Ireland herself, but her parents came from there, driven by poverty to earn their living elsewhere, and after faithfully sending over every farthing they could screw out of their own necessities to the old folks at home, died in the same poverty here. Bridget is devoted to the child, and as long as he is in her care, Lily generally seems easy and peaceful. Otherwise, and some strange instinct seems to tell her when this is the case, she gets nervous at once and is always restless and uneasy. Once she awoke with a scream in the middle of the night, declaring, "Something was wrong with the baby. Nurse had gone away and left it. She was sure of it." To pacify her, I threw on my dressing gown and ran up the nursery to see. And true enough, though the boy was all right and sound asleep, nurse was absent, having gone up to the cook's room to get something for her toothache. She came back the next moment, and I returned to satisfy Lily, but she would scarcely listen to me. "Is it gone?" she asked. "Was the nursery door open?" "Oh, if it had been, thank God you were in time to drive the thing down. But how could it have got into the house?" "It? What?" I repeated, staring. "The dog you passed on the stairs. I saw it as it ran past the door. A big black dog." "My dear, you're dreaming. I passed no dog, nothing at all." "Oh, Harry, didn't you see it then?" "I did, though it went by so quietly. Oh, is it in the house still?" I seized the candle, went up and down stairs, and searched the whole house thoroughly, but again found nothing. The fancy dog must have been a shadow on the wall only, and I told her so pretty sharply. Yet on two subsequent occasions, when for some reason or another she had the child's cot put beside her own bed at night, I was awoke by finding her sitting up and shaking with fright, while she assured me that something, some animal, had been trying to get into the room. She could hear its breathing distinctly as it scratched at the door to open it. Dr. C. is right. Her nerves are clearly all wrong, and a thorough change is the only thing for her. How glad I am that the builder writes me my carry shooting box is finished. We'll run over there next week. September 26. The Cabin, Kilmoyle Castle, Kerry. Certainly this place is paradise after London, and never did I imagine that by raising the roof as though to transform a garret into a large, bright attic, quite big enough for a nursery, throwing out a couple of bay windows into the two rooms below, and turning an adjoining barn into a kitchen and servants' room, this cottage could ever have been made into such a jolly little box. As for Lily, she's delighted with it, and looks ever so much better already. I'm getting my guns in order for tomorrow, anticipating a pleasant day's shooting. September 27th. Here's an awful bother. Bridget has given warning and declares she will leave today. It seems she knew her mother came from Kerry, and this morning she has found out that the old man who lived in this very cottage was her own grandfather, and that he died of a broken heart within a week of his eviction, having first called down a solemn curse on Kilmoyle and me, and all belonging to us in this world and the next. They also say that he managed to scoop out a grave for his dog, and bury it right in front of the cabin door, and now Bridget is alternately tearing her hair for ever having served under her grandfather's murderer, and weeping over the murderer's baby, the while she packs her box for departure. That wouldn't matter so much, though it's awfully unpleasant, for the housekeeper at the castle will send us someone to mind the boy till we get another nurse. But the disclosure seems to have driven Lily as frantic as Bridget. She entreated me with tears and sobs to give up the cabin and take her and baby back to England before the curse could fall upon us, and wept like one broken-hearted when I told her she must be mad even to suggest such a thing after all the expense I had been to. All the same, it's a hard nuisance. She has been crying all day, and if this fancy grows on her, the change will do her no good, and I shan't know what to do. I'm sorry I was cross to her, poor child, but I was rather out of sorts myself, having been kept awake all night by the ceaseless mournful howling of some unseen cur. Besides, I'm bothered about Kilmoyle. He arranged long ago to be here this week, but the bailiff says he has been ill and is traveling and speaks in a mysterious way, as if the illness were DT. I hope not. I had no idea before that my old chum was even addicted to drink. Anyhow, I won't be balked of a few days' shooting, at all events, and perhaps by that time Lily will have calmed down. October 19th, the castle. It is weeks since I opened this, and I only do so now before closing it forever. I shall never dare to look at it again after writing down what I must today. I did go out for my shooting on the morning after my last entry, and my wife, with the babe in her arms, stood at the cabin door to see me off. The sunlight shone full on them, on the tear stain still dark under her sweet blue eyes, and the downy head and tiny face of the infant on her breast. But she smiled as I kissed my hand to her. I shall never forget that, the last smile that ever. The woman we had brought with us as servant told me the rest. She said her mistress went on playing with a child in the sunshine till it fell asleep, and then laid it in its cot inside and sat beside it rocking it. By and by, however, the maid went in and asked her to come and look at something that was wrong with the new kitchen arrangements, and Lily came out with her. They were in the kitchen about 10 minutes when they heard a wail from the cabin and both ran out. Lily was first and cried out, "Oh, heaven, look! What's that? That great dog, all black and burnt-looking, coming out of the house. Oh, my baby, my baby!" The maid saw no dog and stopped for an instant to look around for it, letting her mistress run on. Then she heard one wild shriek from within, such a shriek as she had never heard in all her life before, and followed. She found Lily lying senseless on the floor and in the cradle of the child, stone dead. Its throat had been torn open by some savage animal, and on the bedclothes and the fresh white matting covering the floor were the blood-stained imprint of a dog's feet. That was 3 weeks ago. It was evening when I came back to hear my wife's delirious shrieks piercing the autumn twilight. Those shrieks from the moment of her being roused from the merciful insensibility which held her for the first hours of her loss, she has never ceased to utter. We have moved her to the castle since then, but I can hear them now. She has never regained consciousness once. The doctors fear she never will. And she never did. The last entry of my diary was written 2 years ago. For 2 years my young wife, the pretty girl who loved me so dearly, and whom I took from such a happy home, has been a raving lunatic, obliged to be guarded, held down, and confined behind high walls. They have been my own walls, and I have been her keeper. The doctors wanted me to send her to an asylum, said it would be for her own good, and on that I consented. But she grew so much worse there. Her frantic struggles and shrieks for me to come to her, to save her from the dog, to keep it off, were so incessant and heart-rending that they sent for me, and I have never left her again. God only knows what that means, what the horror and agony of those 2 years, those ceaseless, piteous cries for a child, our child, those agonized entreaties to me not to go with Kilmoyle, to take her away, away, those, oh, how have I borne it? Today it is over. She is dead, and I scarce dare leave her even yet. Never once in all the time have I been tempted to share the horrible delusion which, beginning in a weak state of health and confirmed by the awful coincidence of our baby's death, upset my darling's brain, and yet now that it is over, I feel as if the madness which slew her were coming on me also. As she lay dying last night, and I watched by her alone, I seemed to hear a sound of snuffling and scratching at the door outside, as though some animal were there. Once indeed I strode to it, and threw it open, but there was nothing. Nothing but a dark fleeting shadow seen for one moment, and the sound of soft, unshod feet going pit-pat, pit-pat upon the stairs as they retreated downwards. It was but my fancy, my own heartbeats, as I knew, and yet if the woman who turned to me out an hour ago should have left her alone, if that sound now. Here the writing came to an abrupt end, the pen lying in a blot across it. At the inquest held subsequently, the footman deposed that he heard his master fling open the study door and rush violently upstairs to the death chamber above. A loud exclamation, the report of a pistol shot, followed almost immediately, and on running to the rescue he found Captain Glennie standing inside the door, for his face livid with horror, and the revolver in his outstretched hand still pointed at a corner of the room on the other side of the bier, the white covering on which had in one place been dragged off and torn. Before the man could speak, however, his master turned round to him and exclaiming, "Williams, I have seen it. It was there, on her. Better this than a madhouse. There is no other escape." Put the revolver to his head and fired. He was dead ere even the servant could catch him.